Bucks lost to the Twins 3-2. Those teams all meet again. Sunny and warm, a high of 70. A lovely morning now, wind west at 10, 53 degrees Kenosha, 52 for Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the 30th of April, the last day of the month, so it is the last day of Organ Donation Awareness Month. And I'm taking the opportunity to share with you an interview I recorded a few days ago with a friend who is a professor of voice at Florida State University. She is also an organ recipient, in fact, a double lung organ recipient. And in today's interview, you're going to hear about this long journey which she has taken, about the physical difficulties which she experienced over the course. Restraints do not allow for the interview in its entirety to air on the broadcast. But if you seek out the podcast version of the morning show, you can hear the entire interview, including that portion in which she talks about where she comes from originally and a little bit of background about her education and her career in music. To find the podcast, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Here now, my shared with me thus far is that this is actually a story that begins all the way back into. Tell us what the very first signs were that something perhaps was amiss.
Well, I was at home for Christmas up in New York, and I got a cold, and I had to fly to Arizona to host a Nats, and I didn't feel well, and I went to the doctor, and he said, "Oh, you have pneumonia. Here's some antibiotics." And I thought, "Walking pneumonia," because I was functioning very well, but it didn't go away. After 2 weeks, I had to take more meds. All or they hearing me in meetings and this and that. And it was super uncomfortable being around musicians, you know, to upset their hearing, what they were hearing. That I had been to wasn't going to help me. He didn't refer me to a pulmonologist or anything like that, which would have been the thing to do. So I got up, and there was a lot of crackling and wheezing, and when I'd lie down, I would hear these noises, and I couldn't sleep through the night because I'd be coughing all night. It was just horrible. And, you know, for a singer to cough, it's so upsetting because we think we're going to damage our vocal folds. And somehow I've come out of this, and my vocal folds are in perfect condition. And there's no scarring, there's none of that. But it was... I was constantly worried about that problem. I couldn't take the deep breaths that I used to take, and I couldn't use the breath the way I did before.
I'm curious about, I want to just ask you a couple things about that. So was it that to take a deep breath as you were accustomed to, was that painful, or was it that it was impossible? I mean, that no matter what you did, whatever discomfort you experienced, it was utterly impossible for you to take in the same amount of air that you had normally been able to.
I think I was trying to take in the same amount I always did. But what did not happen is there's a phenomenon that happens in the lungs. They convert it into oxygen immediately through the alveoli. And the alveoli of my lungs were falling off into the bottom of my lungs. So I didn't have alveoli there to convert it. So then when I went to use it, it was like a fourth of what I had taken that I could use. It was a very strange phenomenon.
Wow. I know that from, I'm anxious to take the story from here, but I know from what you shared with me that at one point, as you were still trying to ascertain exactly what was wrong, that you did some Googling. That is, you know, something that's, in a sense, people do at their peril. One is experiencing an array of symptoms, and there is no clear indication of exactly what these symptoms add up to.
Yes, I did Google my symptoms, and I came up with tuberculosis. So the good news is tuberculosis is treatable. The bad news is it's tuberculosis. So I thought, oh my goodness, I found myself in an opera plot here.
Yeah, no kidding.
I felt like Violetta, you know. So I'm like, okay, bye, you know, sort of like that. And I didn't go to the funeral because I was afraid I was going to be patient zero in a plane full of people.
Spreading tuberculosis.
Spreading tuberculosis. And I thought, no, I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be on the 6 o'clock news for that. I ended up staying at home, and my husband and I just had this quiet little observation, and we lit candles for each of the children, you know, and this and that. And we got through that. And my brothers and sisters have looked at me askance ever since. And I said this like a couple of weeks ago to my sister, now do you see why I didn't go?
Mm.
She says, now I get it.
Wow.
But yeah, it was very difficult. When I finally did get home and I heard about it, he said, it mimics TB. And I said, yes, it does. Because that's what Google told me.
Right. Tell us more about this condition, pulmonary sarcoidosis, and in a sense, what a pulmonologist looks for in order to ascertain that this is the problem.
Well, sarcoidosis causes something called granulomas, which are like little tiny cysty-looking things. They look almost like lymph nodes, but they're not. And they can spread out and become like spurs. And they take up space in your lungs, and they become calcified after a while. So your lungs are flexible, too. He also explained to me that the outside can output of breath. So it does all kinds of things to mess with one. But sarcoidosis is actually not limited to the lungs at all. It can affect.
It could have been more widespread, in other words.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Yes, indeed.
Is there information on what tends to cause this and or trip it into existence? Or is that something of a mystery?
Well, I actually went to a lecture last week. My pulmonologist gave a lecture last week on sarcoidosis because it is Sarcoidosis Awareness Month as well. And she said, you have some genetic predisposition to it. It could be like on 8 of your genes. We don't know which one. It's not one. It's different in different people. Maybe that's why it attacks different organs. And there is something that sets it off. And it's inhaling of something. And she said, we live in a country that has a lot of pollution. We have a lot of farming. We have all kinds of industry. If we live near a chemical plant, if we live near electrical production plant, we are inhaling things that we're not aware of. We're just used to it. And something can set it off. And it also can be exacerbated by stress and those other two things.
Hmm.
So I was looking back and I said, okay, what happened to me in 2000 or 2001? I went to the site of 9/11 and I was there the day they pulled down the last beam of Building 7.
Wow.
I was far away, but, you know, the cloudy smoke, whatever, which hadn't been disturbed in thousands of years. So I could have inhaled anything from any of those two places that I can name.
So tell us what difference this diagnosis made. I mean, once it was determined, well, at least we know what you have, was there treatment available to at least keep this condition in check, if not to cure it? To what extent was it helpful to at least know what the problem was?
Well, to give it a name, demystified it, and I read everything I could read on it. I found other people with it. I actually went to a conference and met other people with it, and that made me feel so different because I was so alone, and then I suddenly wasn't alone. I even found largely undercounted. Symptoms that people who maybe don't have insurance or whatever would not bother with. But for those of us, you know, I was working with my voice. I was working with my breath constantly, and it was really getting in my way. It also stopped me from singing recitals. Part of my job is to give recitals and to give performances publicly, and I just about quit performing publicly. I would do recording because recordings can be fixed and batched, you know, patched, and, you know, you can work with recordings. But even that, I hear them and I go, I didn't get to the end of that phrase the way I wanted to. Oh, no, I didn't get to the end of that phrase either. You know, this is a disappointing product in the end. And I thought, okay, I'm no longer a singer. I'm just not a singer anymore. And another thing that happens is the lung capacity and the lack of oxygen exchange causes memory problems. So there's the panic. Oh, my, which verse is this? You know, something you've been singing for years will suddenly become difficult. And you're thinking, I'm not getting old. It's just my brain is not working because it's got an impediment.
Right. You are. In other words, you are experiencing some oxygen deprivation, and that can have profound effects on us in a lot of different ways. One of the things you mentioned in the information you shared with me is that for you, often these symptoms, especially of the chronic coughing, would often be set off by something as simple as just walking from one room to another, or maybe smelling a different fragrance that you know, that was suddenly in the air. I mean, it's just kind of hard to imagine living life and making your way through a world in which this was kind of an ever-present potential problem.
Well, it was so interesting. I was so sensitive to smell that when I would go into the doctor's office and I would smell perfume from a previous patient, and it always special. But, or, you know, church choir where they say, don't wear any hairspray or perfume for the concert. It's stuff like that. But when I would walk on the hall at school and someone was wearing patchouli, I would just about die. Who's wearing the patchouli? I would say, please don't use that again on this hall, please. So, I don't know. I was trying to put those little fires out as best I could.
How was your life affected in terms of just walking around? I mean, like walking up the stairs, for instance. I'm guessing that when we're talking about oxygen deprivation, that physical activity of any kind, not just singing, would start to become an issue.
Exactly. I've been taking the elevator. I'm the elevator lady. At school for about 4 years, you know, all the things that I can catch from other people, touching handrails doesn't turn me on.
Right. Yeah, we'll get to that in just a moment about, you know, so the ways you have to be careful now. We're speaking with Wanda Brister, a professor of voice at Florida State University, and we're talking about her long health journey on this last day of April, which is Organ Donation Awareness Month, and also Sarcoidosis Month. That is the condition, pulmonary sarcoidosis, that she was diagnosed, something which attacks the lungs, makes so many of the tissues of the lung much less pliable, and really compromises one's ability to deeply breathe, and affects you know, nearly every aspect of one's life. I know that early on after the diagnosis, a lot of different medications were tried to combat these symptoms, these worsening symptoms. And I guess at one point then the choice was made that maybe we need to be still more aggressive. Tell us about that point in the story and if anything in particular led to that decision.
Well, I came to a new pulmonologist in Gainesville, Florida, Divya Patel, and she's a specialist in sarcoidosis. That's the only thing she treats. And so she knows it intimately. And she's now working with a German drug company to try to develop specific drugs for this disease. Dr. Patel asked me, tell me about your quality of life. And I said, well, I can't walk from the garage to my car without stopping four times. She said, oh, no, no, no. And then she took care of that with a handicap sticker. And we, you know, have to get over the handicap sticker thing. It's upsetting to have to put that on your car. And I mean, I'm like, I'm not an old crippled person, so people are not going to understand. Yeah. But anyway, the she started asking these questions, and she put me on some more aggressive treatments. And she said, let's try this. Let's try this. I said, let's throw everything we can at it. I'm not afraid. I think I need to introduce you to the lung team.
Wow. Can I just ask you about one other thing before that? I know yes. that I think, if I understand the progression of steps here, that ahead of that was the moment when you were essentially put on
the chance that it's going to work.
Wow.
I said, yeah. So, like, okay. So we just spent the night there that night and waited, and we were waiting essentially for that person to pass away. And I was just, you know, hoping for them that it was quiet and comfortable and all the things. And I had a good night's sleep, and the next morning I woke up and nothing, they came to me like at 2 p.m. and took me away. So it was a long journey.
Do you know anything about the person whose lungs are now part of your body? Are you told anything about them?
I don't know. I'm not told anything about them. I'm not told if they're male or female. I'm not told anything about race, ethnicity, any of that. But I did have a funny craving for a lot of Mexican food afterwards. It was very funny. I thought, now I know I liked Mexican before, but this is a little crazy.
Interesting.
So I started calling my lungs abuelita. And it was like, wow. Maybe I'm right. I don't know. But actually, there is an actual ceremonious kind of thing you do around, they say don't write a letter until after your first year, and write a letter to the to the family. And it's recommended that you not mention anything about God or religion. We don't know who it is. Helped me do this and this and this, and how grateful you are for it. So it's very, very difficult to write these letters. And you send it to UNOS, which is the place that procures all the information from all the hospitals about who needs what. And they know who the donor was, and they forward it to the family. And the family can then write back or not, but they write back to UNOS again, and then UNOS can disperse the information as you become more chatty with the family.
Wow. So you have not yet written such a letter, of course, because it has not been a year since you received your lungs, but what an interesting thing to anticipate. How lengthy is the...
Well, it's typically a 12-hour surgery, and my surgery was about, I think it was like 9.5 to 10 hours. It wasn't quite 10 hours. They do three different things. This is going to sound horrible to a voice teacher. They cut below the larynx. they cut the trachea, and then they cut three places where the lungs and the heart are connected, and they put the heart on an ECMO machine. I'm not sure what ECMO stands for, but it's an electronic breathing thing. And, of course, you're on oxygen the whole time, but you're not able to breathe. So it's bizarre.
Wow.
ECMO keeps you alive during this. And they make those three cuts, and they take all the lungs out, and then they put the new lungs in, and they supposedly fit perfectly. They choose a person who has a similar stature and weight and all of that. So they put them in, and they sew all of these things back together and make sure they're talking to each other, and then they take you off to ECMO, and then that's the end of it.
Wow.
And they cut what they call a clamshell cut under your breasts. So the men come out looking like they have these super pecs, you know. And the women are like, oh, my God. Because we have the boobage, of course, and we have the whole thing about how do I get this out of the way. And so it's interesting. They staple things. They staple it closed. So it's not stitches in the old-fashioned way.
Hmm.
It's stapled. And they take a few staples out every few weeks. So they'll say, we'll take a half out this week, and then next week we'll take another half. And you know, it took them about 7 weeks to get all my staples out.
Wow. Tell us about the recovery period. I mean, in the immediate wake of the surgery, which needless to say was successful, I imagine the process of just recovering from such a long and extensive surgery can't be all that easy.
Oh, it's difficult. I was so, first of all, the anesthesia really made me crazy. It made me really crazy. I was seeing all kinds of things and just, you know, experiencing extreme noise consciousness. There was a machine in my room that kept making this noise, and I kept asking the nurse, what is the noise? And like, I don't hear anything, you know. And finally, one of the breathing people came in, and I said, what is that noise? She said, oh, that's the machine cleaning your feeding tube, something, something. I said, okay, I'm not crazy. She said, no, you're not crazy. It's like, you know, singers and hearing and musicians and hearing, it's just really important to us.
Yeah.
And like, I don't want to be hearing things the rest of my life, right?
Right.
So the first hours of consciousness were like, very interesting that way.
Mm.
Like, you're on super, super sensitive load. Everything is sensitive, and light and sound and everything is so sensitive. But yeah, it was hard because there were nerves that were just shocking, like from one arm down the whole leg or whatever. Things that were just not in the right place yet. They hadn't found themselves, their homes yet.
Mm.
And I couldn't eat for 8 days, which, considering hospital food, was kind of okay.
Wow.
But I asked my doctor when I could eat. I said, can I have Chipotle?
Mm.
And he said, sure, you can have Chipotle. Yeah.
So at what point were you able to, in a sense, sense a difference in your breathing, that your ability to breathe was something at least? So immediately you knew the difference.
You could
tell the
immediately.
Difference. Well, that's a good thing.
My husband looked at me, he says, you have new lungs on. And I said, I know.
So at that point, you had that level of awareness then. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I had a bunch of tubes in my nose, and I wasn't sure what the tubes were. One was a feeding tube, and one was, they were feeding me some oxygen. I said, I just want to take the oxygen out. I want to breathe room air. Come on, let me breathe. And like, I'm going to do it tomorrow or whatever. I said, okay. So they took them out, eventually. And then the feeding tube was the one that was just dangling, you know, the dangling tube. I ran into a fellow yesterday who had his the next day, and he still had his feeding tube in. I said, Bob, when are they going to take that thing away? He said, I'm hoping to do it today. I said, I hope so. And he did.
So tell us about this post-surgery period in which, as you were telling me earlier, before we went on the air, you are being extremely cautious, exceedingly cautious in terms of trying to avoid infection and other issues. What is the extent to which you really have to be careful about what you do and where you go and so on?
Well, unfortunately, I had been a little bit cavalier about it. I went out and I went to restaurants and I went, and I'm not saying every day, probably three times in the 8 weeks. And I was very careful. I had Purell with me and I had my mask with me. I was always wearing a you know, 95 mask. And I would take the, for instance, if they delivered a beverage, I would take the Purell and I would go around the entire glass. I would fill my hands with it and just go around the entire glass with the Purell. Did the same thing with the forks and anything I touched. So that was, you know, proactive kind of stuff. But somehow I got COVID. I got exposed to COVID, and I don't know where, and it's not important, I guess, where it was. But I did. So I have learned that I have to stay home, and I can't even go to my physical therapy now because of the COVID. So, yeah. So there are certain things that the hospital says, and my numbers, are unfortunately, are not climbing enough. So after COVID, apparently there are certain antibodies, and once you have so many antibodies, they say you're no longer contagious. But my antibodies are not. One thing we have to do is keep a lot of data. Every day we in the morning and the evening, we take blood pressure, we take our weight, blood pressure, oxygen level, heart rate, and then we do this device called an FEV1, which is a, you just inhale really big and you blow as fast as you can, and it measures your lung volume for that moment. And so they've been watching that. And reactions to any of the meds, the nurses have been really superb about changing around meds. Like I said, my feet are swollen. Oh, well, we need to get you off of this, and we need to put you on this. And I said, great. And it worked immediately. So I was like, okay, they've had enough of these patients to know who has what kind of symptoms and what to do for it.
Amazing.
It's really amazing. Yeah.
Well, this is such an amazing story, and I appreciate you sharing it so vividly. You're a born storyteller. A last question, and I'm afraid Organ Donor Awareness Month, and it is, of course, also sarcoidosis month, Awareness Month. A quick word to those who might be wondering if it makes sense.
I've been an organ donor since I got my first driver's license. I don't know what made me aware of it, or maybe I saw a story on television or something. I don't know. But I just did it. And I remember my mother and I having a discussion about it and her saying, well, what about the rapture? And what about your, you know, I said, that was the argument. And so I realized that it was important to make myself available if I'm no longer useful, you know? And my high school chorus teacher had told me he was donating his body to science. And I thought, that's a wonderful thing to do.
Well, we're glad
doing the same.
We're glad that somebody saw fit to do the same. And the result are two healthy lungs with which now you can breathe properly and freely. And we wish you a continued healthy and uneventful recovery. and a return to all that you want to do in the very, very near future. Wanda Brister, I really appreciate you taking the time to tell this story and to tell it so effectively. We wish you only the very, very best going forward, and thanks for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview originally scheduled to air last Friday, an interview with the author of a book called Mutt's Dream. Mutt was the nickname of Mickey Mantle's father. And in the book Mutt's Dream, we learn about the incredibly close relationship between Mickey Mantle and his father, and the ferocious determination with which Mickey Mantle's father pushed his talented son into a career in Major League Baseball. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear will join us to offer his commentary on various current issues and events. And on Friday, among other things, we will preview the next concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, a concert which will feature great film music. Our weather forecast today is for mostly sunny skies and warm conditions, a high of 70 degrees, a few clouds rolling in, and a slight chance of overnight rain with an overnight low of 52. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 73. Thursday will be cloudier, and both Thursday and Friday there is a 60% chance of rain, with Thursday's high 76, Friday's high 70. It looks like mostly sunny skies over the weekend. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and